Welcome to the 12th annual Renewing Our Spirit Conference. 11 years ago, Torah Motion began with Renewing Our Spirit. We didn't know then it would be number one, our annual conference. And over the past 11 years, close to 350 speakers have joined us here in Toronto. We have well over 1,000 talks that are all available on our website. As of Friday afternoon, there were 7,340 people on our email list in at least 32 countries. People who live in Toronto think of Torah in Motion as a Toronto-based organization. I can tell you that at least 80% of the people who interact with us do not live in Toronto. The power of social media and the internet, of course, our three biggest markets are Canada, the United States, and Israel. We've got Australia, England, you name it. And a lot of, on the trips that we do, that you'll see in our brochures, people come from Australia because they get our emails. And so it's really, we've grown into, people know us all around the world. Know us in Toronto too, I hope, a little bit. But through our emails, they get our Debrei Torah, our program announcements. Now, of course, I'm sure many of you know, we started a Daf Yomi blog, whatever you want to call it. And we have, over the years, partners with shuls, countless shuls, organizations all over the world. Our annual medical ethics conference attracts really some of the top medical people in the world as our participants, not even as our speakers. We've started running trips. I see people in the room who've been on our trips. These are really our wonderful trips on Jewish history. In short, we become an internationally known organization, and we look forward to many more years of growth. Thank you. 11 years ago, the Krauss family had the vision, Sarah and Larry and Larry's mother had the vision to give Torah in Motion really our seed money to get the organization started. And I want to thank Larry for his ongoing support year after year. Every year he sponsors a conference in memory of his father, and we should for many years work together and be together on happy occasions as friends. And I want to thank you on a personal level on behalf of the organization. Thank you very much. This year is our largest group of speakers. We have a total of 9 speakers, and for the first time ever, we are tripling up our sessions, as you'll see tomorrow. So there is something for everybody. We're even having a quadruple session for one of our sessions. So we invite you all, if you haven't registered yet, to come for tomorrow. Come for part of the day, all the day, whatever you can make it. And we look forward to a great weekend of learning. It's really, we say, We begin with the honor of our host, but I'll end my remarks with the honor of our host to thank, Sher Shemaim, where we've hosted the program, who's hosted us for many, many years. And I want to call on the Rabbi Strachler, who I want to wish a mazel tov on the recent birth of a baby daughter just a few weeks ago. And I really want to thank him also on a personal level for all the help and the wonderful work he's doing in the shul. Thank you, Rabbi.
I want to echo Jay's words and really give a yashar koach to Torah in Motion for its wonderful work. It's a privilege for us as a shul to be able to be a home for Torah in Motion. And as Jay noted, this is an organization which has an international presence. And you can say, really, Kimi Toronto Tete Torah, as a function of the good work of Torah in Motion. And so thank you for coming and participating and supporting this important work, and for continuing the engagement of great ideas, great Jewish ideas, to take place through the conversations that take place here, and over the course of years has really expanded and broadened the creative thinking that takes place both in Toronto and also in the Jewish world as a whole. So yishar koach to you, yishar koach to Dr. Melamed, to Rabbi Kelman, and may you go from strength to strength.
Good evening. I'm Dr. Eliyahu Malamed on behalf of the Hart and Malamed families, as well as Rabbi Kelman and myself at Torah in Motion. Thank you for coming. This evening is sponsored by our families in memory of my father's 6th Yahrzeit. This coming Shabbat, which is the 6th of Kislev, marks the 6th Yahrzeit of my father, Colin Malamud, Kolonius Kalman ben Menachem Nachum HaLevi. My father was born in Dresden and escaped Germany in the 1930s. It's thus fitting that this coming Shabbat also coincides with the English calendar of November 9th, which, as you all know, is the 75th anniversary of Kristallnacht, the night of the broken glass. On Kristallnacht in Dresden, 151 Jews were arrested and were shipped to Buchenwald. The synagogues were burned, and actually the Nazis presented the Jewish community with the bill for their demolition. In November 2009, which was just 4 years ago, the synagogue of Dresden was desecrated with swastikas just ahead of the anniversary of Kristallnacht, despite regular round-the-clock police surveillance. And that would not have surprised my father, whose own father was killed by the Nazis. But by 1938, my dad had left Germany and moved to England and thus eventually made his way to Palestine. Rav Yehuda Amital described the Shoah and its aftermath as a world built, destroyed, and rebuilt. And my father participated in that rebuilding, first in Israel and then in Canada. His world was destroyed. He rebuilt a world with his wife, my mother Ahuva, may she live and be well, and his children and grandchildren, his love of Judaism and the land of Israel, may his memory be for a blessing. The media coverage of the Arab-Israeli conflict has generated many complaints of partisan reporting, probably more than any other news topic. It seems as if every story, every word that's printed about Israel and the Palestinians is subject to dispute, not the least of which is how to describe Israeli territory, disputed territories versus occupied territories, security fence versus apartheid wall, natural growth versus illegal expansion, freedom fighter versus terrorist, self-defense versus aggression. There's no term that is not under dispute. This extends not just to the words used, but to the words not used or to the facts omitted. Are the positions of both parties regularly and accurately portrayed within a given media outlet? Each side accuses the other of lies, decontextualization, exaggeration, sensationalism, one-sidedness, prejudice, not bothering to check facts, and so on. Is there media bias against Israel, or is this overstated in Jewish communities? How does one report on a situation that creates so much passion in so many people around the world? And even as this war of words rages, new and intriguing uses of the media, specifically social media, have also become hotly disputed, such as how much did Facebook and Twitter play a role in the Arab Spring? Was their role overrated? Is there increasing press freedom in the Arab world, or is this mythical? Will it play a role in changing attitudes on both sides? Why is this important? Because it turns out to no one's surprise that Israel is more reported on and garners more news interest than any place on earth. As one of our panelists, Shmuel Rosner, has indicated, in the 2008 American vice presidential debate, Israel's name was mentioned 17 times. China was mentioned twice. Europe just once. Russia didn't come up at all. Not Britain, not France, not Germany. So the world seems endlessly interested in Israel, the Palestinians, and the Arab nations, and the media is a key element in how perceptions about how that part of the world are formed. So I therefore thought it was really timely to invite four journalists to discuss these and other issues, and my gratitude goes out to them for participating this evening. It's my pleasure to introduce them to you in alphabetical order, and I'm going to ask you to hold your applause until all the introductions are finished. Next to me, Mr. Jonathan Kay, who's the Common Pages editor of the National Post. In addition, he's a columnist for the Post's op-ed page. Mr. Kay's freelance articles have appeared in various publications, including Commentary, Harper's, The New Yorker, The New York Times, The International Herald Tribune, The LA Times, The New Republic, and Newsweek. And in 2002, he was awarded Canada's National Newspaper Award for critical writing. Mr. Kay holds a BA and MA from McGill University in metallurgical engineering. Bet you didn't know that. Mr. Kay then studied at Yale Law School, where he received his law degree in 1997. And before joining the Post, he worked as a lawyer in New York City. To my immediate left, Ms. Tova Lazaroff is the deputy managing editor of the Jerusalem Post, where she has worked as a correspondent since 2000. Her expertise includes West Bank settlements, diplomacy, the United Nations, hostage swaps, the southern and northern borders under fire, and terror victims. And before arriving in Israel in April of 2000, she had spent 8 years as a local reporter in the Boston area, where she earned 12 awards from the New England Press Association and 7 from the Massachusetts Press Association for her work. She has a BA in history from Brandeis and is a native of Brookline, Massachusetts. To her left, Shmuel Rosner, who's an Israeli columnist and editor. He's the political editor of the Jewish Journal and writes a weekly column for the International New York Times. For several years, until about 5 years ago, he wrote for Haaretz, and his blog entitled Rosner's Domain is featured in the Jerusalem Post. He's also written for the New Republic, the Jewish Review of Books, the Jewish Chronicle, and other publications. In 2009, Mr. Rosner was appointed the nonfiction editor for Kinneret's Morah Bitan Dvir, which is an Israeli publishing house. He has also joined the Jewish People Policy Institute as a fellow and started writing a weekend column on diplomatic and American affairs for Maariv. And to my right here, David Weinberg, who writes on Israeli diplomacy and defense, Israeli politics and society, and Israel-Diaspora relations. He holds a master's degree in international relations from Bar-Ilan. His work has appeared in the Jerusalem Post and Israel Hayom, among other publications. He moved to Israel in 1990 from Toronto. As senior advisor to Natan Sharansky, he was the founding coordinator of the Global Forum Against Anti-Semitism. He's also served as a spokesman for the Herzliya Conference on National Security and for Bar-Ilan, and as public affairs director for the Begin Sadat Center for Strategic Studies at Bar-Ilan University. He also studied at the Hebrew University, Yeshivat HaKotel, and Har Etzion. Please welcome our speakers. I'd like to start with the issue of language in journalism and begin with you, Mr. Kay. There are disagreements that can be seen on a daily basis in the media about what is the right designation for certain acts. In other words, what is a just term to describe someone who blows up or shoots 5, 10, 100 other people who are just minding their business in the mall, in the marketplace, on the bus? The difficulty in defining and accurately employing charged words that carry moral connotations can be seen in journalists' own struggles to delineate why they use certain words and in what context. Here's an example, before we go to Mr. Kay, of Clark Hoyt of the New York Times in November of 2008. And you'll all recall that there was an immense massacre in Mumbai, India, horrific carnage. And he described it this way. When 10 young men in an inflatable lifeboat came ashore in Mumbai and went on a rampage with machine guns and grenades, taking hostages, setting fires, and murdering men, women, and children, they were initially described by the New York Times by many labels. They were militants, gunmen, attackers, and assailants. Their actions were described as coordinated terrorist attacks, but the men themselves were not called terrorists. But Hoyt understands that words have moral meanings, that meanings are not interchangeable. So he says what you call someone matters. If he's a terrorist, he's an enemy of all civilized people, and his cause is less worthy of consideration. So I'm wondering here, what are the criteria for how language should be employed in such situations? And of course, this has direct bearing on the Israeli-Palestinian situation.
Sure. This became a huge issue about a decade ago, when some of the press agencies stopped using the term terrorist and they started using the term militant. And a lot of people got very upset by it for the obvious reason that it seemed to strip the moral distinction between someone who goes into a cafe and blows himself up and someone who is a militant, for instance, who joins a guerrilla force and acts in a quasi-military capacity. And at the time, people were very upset by it. The dispute has receded a little bit, and I think a lot of journalists, including myself, what we now do is we try and describe the actions of the person. So if it is a suicide bomber, I don't say he's a terrorist. I don't say he's a militant. I say he's a suicide bomber. And if space permits, I describe this was a suicide bomber who went into such and such a civilian place and blew himself up. And every thinking person who reads it, when I describe the actions, will draw their own conclusions. Now, there are going to be people who read those words and say, aha, but, you know, he's in the context of this struggle or that struggle, he's actually a martyr. That's fine. I'm not going to change that person's mind by the choice of word I use. But I think the most responsible thing to do is to actually, if space permits, describe the actions of the person. And by the way, I should say that there are contexts around the world where it actually is legitimately contentious whether someone's a terrorist. I'm thinking in certain contexts in Sri Lanka during the Tamil Tigers struggle against the Sri Lankan government before the Tamil Tigers were destroyed. That was a terrorist group, but certain of their actions were quasi-military. In Pakistan and Afghanistan, certain Taliban actions are clearly terrorism. Other actions have a quasi-military aspect to them. So there are contexts around the world where there is some dispute about it. But in general, I think the best solution for journalists is to simply describe the actions of the people who are killing others and rely on the moral compass of the reader.
I'm wondering, on this side, is there ever policy instructions that are given out about these things? In other words, do people tell you when you're writing about this that there are certain words to use, certain words to avoid?
Well, of course, there are instructions, and they are different for different news organizations. But in general, I already see a problem with this panel. I'm not sure we are going to have much of a dispute here. Because I remember being the head of the news division for Haaretz, which is a newspaper fairly on the left, some would say the radical left of Israel. And during the second intifada, we were constantly having these debates. How do you describe a car bomb? In Israel, the common term for a car bomb was mechonit tofet. Tofet is a loaded word. It means, how would you translate it? I'm not even sure. My English is not good enough to understand what...
Explosive.
No, tofet is much more than explosive. It's like hellish. It's it's a loaded term. And we decided at some point to drop the term mechonit tofet and replace it with something more neutral.
Which was
more like a car bomb. Not a hellish car bomb, just a car bomb. And some of our readers were upset with this decision, but the decision was just a professional journalistic decision to try and keep the news pages as neutral as possible when we describe events. And this is something that all news organizations do. And trying to identify these loaded terms and eliminate them from the news pages of a newspaper is a reasonable thing to do.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm going to both agree and disagree with Shmuel and with Tari Jonathan. I think it's great in a situation where you can just describe the action, right? So if I drive a plane or if I fly a plane into the Twin Towers and I kill thousands of people, I think whether I say that I'm a terrorist or I not say that I'm a terrorist, you know, the situation is kind of obvious. Even in a situation of a car bomb, if it's a hellish car bomb, if it's not a hellish car bomb, if it killed 20 people, you know, you almost don't need the descriptive language. But I think part of the problem, at least with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, is that the basic language that we use to describe much more ordinary things it almost proscribes opinion, and that it's very hard to have neutral language, right? Do I say it's the West Bank? Do I say it's Judea and Samaria, exactly like you were saying? Do I say it's the separation barrier, which I believe Haaretz says, or do I say it's the security barrier, which the Jerusalem Post says, right? Right there, you start to see the difference in the narrative. Is it an outpost? Is it a legal neighborhood? And the moment you make a choice, then the next thing that happens is everybody attacks you for having an opinion. But at some level, you have to write something, right? You have to say something to either locate it geographically, to talk about a separation barrier, to talk about whether or not it's a settlement, an illegal settlement. At some point, you have to choose words. And as the conflict goes on, there are less and less neutral words. And I think the lack of neutrality is probably symbolic of how divisive the conflict has become.
So just to mix it up and to disprove you, Shmuel, that we're all going to agree on this panel.
I was counting on you to disprove me.
This was coordinated in advance, guys. This is too sophisticated for me. The reluctance to call terror, terror, or barbarism, in my mind, reflects moral relativism and a loss of self-confidence in our own sense of values. It's not hard to identify barbaric acts, whether it's the use of chemical weapons or walking into a pizza parlor. And the media seems to be so careful about making moral judgments, so careful about its objective neutrality, except when it comes to Israel. Then it knows how to moralize about Israel's soul, then it knows to make moral judgments, it knows how to lecture Israel about its own morality. So there's a problem. There's a problem. I would like to see, I expect to see media coverage in the Western world inflected with a sense of moral outrage when barbarism rears its head. And it bothers me that we retreat into professional neutrality as a way of protecting ourselves against protagonists on either side.
If I can just jump in, I don't think it's only Israel that gets this treatment. News editors have been struggling to find the right terms to define the rebels in Syria. There are some rebels in Syria who fight in a quasi-military way. There are other rebels in Syria who blow up civilian targets. And sometimes it's not quite clear. The Nusra Front in Syria basically flies the black flag of al-Qaeda. Do we call them terrorists? Do we call them terrorists when they're allied with other rebel groups and they wear uniforms and they attack Syrian troops? It's not so clear. In Afghanistan and Pakistan and other theaters, the same issues have been faced. So it's not only Israel that gets news editors wringing their hands and deciding what term to use. This is an issue that since 2011, I think, people all over the world have been struggling with. And I also take issue with the idea that we have to strike a clear moral argument with every term we use. Like sometimes I watch the Arab media in translation, they'll talk about martyrdom operations when they mean what you and I would call terrorism. And in their mind, they're striking a clear moral tone. They're saying these are martyrdom operations, these are justified. Well, those guys are striking a clear moral voice in their news coverage, and I think it's ridiculous. I think it's appalling. I think, you know, I'd love to see the Arab media strive for a little bit of neutrality. So I think news editors all over the world, regardless of whether they're talking about Israel, I don't think it's a bad thing to strive for professional neutrality.
Can I just get some clarification? In radio, TV, print, who makes the call on the words that get used? Is it the person writing the story, or is it the person who's overseeing sort of the editor and so forth?
Shmuel was saying that, you know, sometimes there's these very heated conferences that take place within publications about what term to use, but those typically only govern the news pages. When we have an op-ed writer or a columnist, we typically allow the op-ed writer or the columnist to use any term they want because the choice of vocabulary is critical to the argument. So it's a very different discussion when you're talking about editorial writing and opinion writing and news coverage, because news coverage, they're, you know, it's much more, I would use the term professional, because they really are striving for a particular kind of professional tone, whereas, you know, in my world of opinion writing, it's more of a free-for-all.
And does anybody ever tie your hands? Does anybody ever say, you can't use that word, or you have to take that
word
out?
Well, in some cases, there are, in serious news publications, there are guidelines, and you have to follow your guidelines. If the guidelines say that you need, for example, that the territories occupied by Israel in 1967 are to be called the occupied territories or the West Bank or Judea and Samaria for that matter, then the people working for the news organization should follow the rules of the organization.
So what was the guideline at Haaretz for how to describe that territory?
I honestly don't remember, but I'd be surprised if it's not the occupied territories.
And Jerusalem Post, is there a guideline, or can each reporter choose the term?
We definitely don't say occupied territory. There are guidelines. Most of them are set by the editor, and sometimes they're set in consultation with reporters. In terms of the West Bank specific, the decision was to really match our language to that of Israeli law. So if you want to think about it, most international publications match their language to their understanding of what international law is, right? So, for example, they'll talk about East Jerusalem as a settlement, okay? The neighborhoods of East Jerusalem as a settlement, because they think that Israel, that East Jerusalem doesn't belong to Israel. But in the Jerusalem Post, for example, we consider Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, as part of Israel. So we would never refer to, say, Pisgat Ze'ev as a settlement, right? But because the West Bank is under military rule and it isn't under regular Israeli law, we refer to communities in the West Bank as settlements. And we use West Bank to talk generally about the entire area, Judea and Samaria, to talk about Area C. And we use those terms interchangeably.
You know, it's nice to believe that there's always a clear and neat division between the news divisions and the opinion divisions of a newspaper. And perhaps in the case of the National Post or other professional organizations, that's the case. It's kind of ridiculous to talk about it in the context of Haaretz, where opinion news articles masquerade as opinion articles masquerade as news on the front page, and loaded terms are part and parcel of both the front page headlines and the selection of what goes into the paper. So you know, there's a little bit too much self-justification and self-righteousness in this retreat to professional neutrality as a refuge for making moral judgments. Syria, the examples you gave, Mr. K, is of course a different case. There is, according to Israeli military intelligence, more than 200 different militias fighting the Assad regime, some of whom change flags every other day, most of whom have one or another backer in the Arab world, and almost all of whom are targeting civilians from rival camps. So, you know, getting into the terms of using terrorism in such a situation is obviously more complicated. It's barbarism on all sides, and there's no reason not to call it that.
I'd like to clarify something. First of all, I'd like to clarify that I'm not here defending Haaretz. I've worked for Haaretz for many years. I'm no longer under any obligation to defend them. What I do try to defend here is what you dismissively described as sophistication. I think that looking for simplicity, for clarity, in an area that has no clarity to it. When you are searching for a unanimous decision to call anyone who hits a civilian a terrorist, I would ask you, well, would you apply the term terrorist to a 9-year-old boy throwing a stone at a car in which civilians ride from Jerusalem to a settlement? I think that calling him a terrorist would probably be an overstatement. You might say he's a terrorist. It's a reasonable discussion to have, but if a newspaper decides not to call this child a terrorist, I don't think it will be an outrageous decision.
Israeli courts treat such 9-year-olds who often kill people with their stones, they treat them as terrorists, general terrorists. Nevertheless, their act is one of protest that is terrorist in nature. They're not.
Well, then you've lost everybody. I mean, if you're going to call a 9-year-old a terrorist, then you've lost me, and you've probably lost a lot of people in the room. So,
and if he's 13-year-old, then he's a terrorist?
But that's the point. There's distinctions to be made. So what's the harm in a news organization seeking to be professional about it? And by the way, news reporters and editors, they often have lofty ambitions, and I'm going to cite a lofty ambition here, which is you want to try and build a vocabulary that people can have a discussion. And when you use terms, when I'm talking to someone and they describe a terrorist as a martyr, I can't have a conversation with that person because they've used a piece of vocabulary that says they're in another moral universe. I believe as journalists, to the extent that we make a positive contribution to the world of ideas and maybe even peacemaking, if I can be morally exalted, you want to create a vocabulary that maybe joins people on both sides. When I talk about the West Bank and Gaza in an article, I try and use the terms West Bank or Gaza. I try and use the term gunman, or I try and use the term suicide bomber. I try and use terms that both sides agree on. Because as soon as you pick a piece of vocabulary that immediately alienates half your readers, and you say, aha, I've struck a moral point, I'm not a relativist, I can stand tall. Well, good for you. But creating news, creating opinion, one of the goals is to create a conversation among people on both sides, and not simply to talk to people on your side as if you're in a news silo and score points.
And you are worried about disagreement.
I guess you have to ask yourself, what's the point of the news media, and what's its role? Is its role to create conversations?
We're part of the marketplace of ideas.
Is its concern not to alienate readers and lose readership and lose subscribers? Or does it have a role in interpreting for its readers, in moral terms, the world out there?
Well, it sounds like the kind of readers you have in mind have already made up their mind, which is fine. I mean, on most issues I write about, 80% of people have already made up their mind, and that includes the Middle East. But there's that other 20% out there who, I don't think you're doing a service for them if you're using a vocabulary that already signals to them that their mind should be made up in a certain way. If you're writing opinion, that's fine. If you're a news editor, on the other hand, I applaud efforts to be neutral and to be professional.
I wanted to take this a bit further, since obviously the preoccupation with the Middle East is also what charges these discussions. Mr. Rosner, you have written that if you put aside for the moment of like whether you're pro or anti-Israel, it seems that the surest way to get an op-ed published anywhere in the United States is to write something about Israel. And I'm wondering why this extraordinary preoccupation. I mean, beyond the fact that, Israel is the nexus point for the three major Western faiths, I get that. But to what do you account this ongoing and ever-present interest?
Well, first of all, this was not a complaint. I make a career out of it. So why Israel fascinates North American audiences or just people around the world? Partially because of the reasons you just mentioned. Also because it's a fascinating place. There is always something going on. Usually a war, and if there's no war, there is a peace process, and then the crises accompanying any peace process, and people of great importance often visit the area. There's always something to write about. It's an amazing place and a fascinating place, and people feel very strongly about it. For some reason, conflict in Israel, whether it's the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but also conflicts related to religion or conflict related even to domestic affairs in Israel, they draw the attention of mass audiences. And people got used to think about Israel as this place in which things happen, in which news happen. So they easily turn their attention to Israel.
Do you agree?
Yeah, I mean, I think... Sorry, I would divide it into two. First of all, obviously, Israel is the birthplace of three religions. So that covers a massive amount of the world population who are then going to care about what happens in Israel. But I also think there's something about the fact that the conflict has gone on since 1967. It's a very well-known conflict right? People have opinions about it, and they can relate to it because they've been dealing with it for so long. If it's something that's happened in Rwanda, if it's something that's happened in Kyrgyzstan, they don't know the storyline, so it's much harder for them to relate to what is actually happening. Is where you talk about Israel and you talk about the Palestinians, they know a lot about it, so they can have an opinion.
Do you think the majority of the Canadian public has an opinion about this? In other words, yeah. Because what do we have? We have X hundred thousand Jews in this country, so clearly a tiny minority of the populace. Do you think most Canadians care about this issue, and if so, have formed an opinion on this issue?
I don't, actually. My sense is that something like three-quarters of Canadians don't care, and it's astounding, you know, when I talk to someone on the bus about Israel or something like that, they just have the vaguest idea. It's like, oh, yeah, are those guys still killing each other? Like, was that the 9/11 thing? Like, I mean, honestly, like, it's just because, I mean, the, like, people who are willing to spend a Saturday night at an event like this, either on the podium or at a table, they are not the kind of person I just described, obviously. And they tend to have conversations with other people who are also really interested in the Middle East. And the same, by the way, is true when I speak of Muslim or Arab events. You know, often they have the opposite perspective, but they're people who think a lot about the Middle East. And they're often shocked to see survey statistics about how many people are just completely ignorant about the Middle East and don't care about the Middle East. Look, most newspaper readers care about sex, sports, and crime. And, you know...
In that order.
In that kind of order. Well, you know, when they're older, it gets reversed. But I tell people this because, you know, I think sometimes people are in a little bit of a bubble because all the people on their email distribution list, all their friends, you know, their synagogue discussion group, it's sort of, you know, there's a lot of talk about Israel. However, there's even despite what I just said, there still is much more talk about Israel than there is about, you know, comparably sized countries around the world, and that's because people project on the Middle East. If you are, you know, a lot of Americans, you know, who see the American project, you know, building this exceptional civilization and conquering tyrannical societies as they did in the Cold War, they project that project onto Israel because they see Israel as a kindred spirit in that. Evangelical Christians actually see the future of Israel and of Christianity in a way foretold in their scriptures, so there's that aspect to it. Guilty post-colonial studies majors see Israel as the embodiment of all that's bad, and so they project their own guilty neuroses about Western civilization onto Israel. So on every side, the people who are engaged in Israel project things onto. I mean, you can see if you're at Ben Gurion Airport and you see people get off, say, oh, I'm here in the land of you know, honey or whatever, and like they're projecting their, in some cases, nostalgia. Or, you know, I talk to Palestinian activists and they see it as one big concentration camp. Like, there are huge acts of projection coming in from all sides. And that, to my mind, is why Israel has remained such an outsized subject in the media.
So one of the greatest dangers to Israel and for pro-Israel advocates is the attitude of people that you just described. And public opinion polling done here in Canada shows that many Israelis, perhaps not many Canadians, perhaps most Canadians, take the attitude of plague on both their houses. Arabs, the Israelis, fighting, I don't know what happened, 48, 67, San Remo, this, that, the other. It's all very complicated. They've been clobbering each other for years. Let them continue to clobber each other. Just keep us out of it. And that is a great danger because it means that the sense of shared values that we naturally think that Canadians should feel with their fellow democracy in Israel has eroded. And all that's left in their mind is this clouded confusion of warring combatants in the Middle East, a plague on both their houses. Having said that, I think it's important to notice that media coverage in the West of Israel has declined markedly over the last 2 years. And that's primarily because of what's improperly known as the Arab Spring. In Israel, we call it the Islamic Winter or the Arab Earthquakes. The focus on the region is broader. And there is a realization, including among intelligent editors and journalists, that the Arab-Israeli conflict while very important, is not necessarily the be-all and end-all of the problems in the Middle East, and their problems in the Middle East stem from endemic problems in the Arab world. As for long-term obsessive focus on Israel, I'll tell you from a personal perspective. For the last 20-plus years, I've worked with foreign correspondents, Canadian and American foreign correspondents, in Jerusalem. And, you know, it's easy to cover the Middle East from Jerusalem. You can live in a nice home in the German colony and interview the Israeli prime minister in the morning and go to East Jerusalem in the afternoon and sit in a comfortable hotel and interview an important Palestinian. You follow your story. It doesn't require you to go into any danger zones. You don't have to go into Syria and try to interview combatants on all sides. It's very easy to report the Arab-Israeli conflict from Israel. It's a very comfortable place. And that explains a great deal some of the constant focus and over-reporting of Israel and the Arab-Israeli conflict in my mind.
Just staying with you for a moment, we in Canada, the United States, tend to be sort of North American-centric when it comes to thinking about Israel. And I've all have spent some time in Europe. If you go to England, which I've been to many times in the last decade, if you turn on the BBC, you have is definitely a different feel about the way the news is reported there. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about why some of the least friendly media coverage in the world where Israel's concern comes from Europe. And yet, you've noted there are sometimes surprising pockets of support, even a place like Norway. But sticking with the first question first, why do you think that kind of attitude emerges from Europe?
Europe. Totally different story. Earlier this year, January 27th, to be exact, International Holocaust Remembrance Day, the London Times, the Sunday Times, published an editorial cartoon. This was several days after Prime Minister Netanyahu was re-elected Prime Minister. An editorial cartoon that showed Netanyahu building a wall, using Palestinian blood as cement and Palestinian skulls as building bricks, as the brick and mortar. And the subheadline was, "Israeli elections, will cementing peace continue?" Now, this was obvious attempt to echo the pharaohs of Egypt and their oppression of the Jews. And any person who went to Sunday school, whether Jewish or Christian, knows the midrash about how the Egyptians used Jewish babies to build the pyramids and the other structures, cementing them into the wall. And when a cartoon like this appears on International Holocaust Remembrance Day, not in a crackpot fringe publication, but in the Sunday Times, you know it's meant to say, well, the new Nazis are the Israelis, who are literally baking Palestinians into their security fence. And that says to me that there's far more at work in the psyche of the European media when it comes to Israel than simple reportage. I understand it as the following. Europe wants to see itself as virtuous. The EU project, in their minds, in the minds of Europeans, frees them of ugly nationalism, frees them from the ugly history of the abuse of power in Europe. The criticism of Israel and Zionism and Jews and the United States has a liberating dimension. They're free of all that ugly background, and because they've identified a new nemesis. The Jew in European thinking today is no longer the Shylock Jew, he's the Rambo Jew. The Rambo Jew is not a victim as he should be, as the Jew should be. He's now an oppressor. He's now a victimizer. And when you've created that transformation, when you've mutated the image of the Jew from Shylock to Rambo, then Rambo becomes someone that you can advocate against. And therefore, European coverage of Israel is something altogether different. It has echoes of Europe's dark, deep past, their own need to overcome that, to disassociate themselves from that. And they can do that by identifying Israel as just as bad and evil as they used to be. And therefore, when you talk about Europe, all sorts of new things come into the picture. Ingrained anti-Semitism, post-colonialist guilt, and an attempt to evade their ugly past. It's a completely different issue. My colleagues in Jerusalem who work with the European journalists, British, French, and others, have a completely different task.
One thing you didn't mention that I'm wondering about is anything about Muslim demographic in those countries have any influence on media, or is it unconnected?
Yeah, I assume you're right. It's a fair assumption. I don't have any way of measuring that. I do know, however, that it doesn't necessarily reflect public opinion in its totality. Over the last couple of years, I've become exposed to the Christian evangelical world in Europe, which is significant, not reflected politically, but there are tens and hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of European Christian Zionists who advocate for Israel and are as frustrated with their media as we are. I recently spent a week in Norway with my wife, where we were invited by the pro-Israel lobby, 99% non-Jews, most of them serious Christians. Their battle with their own media is just the same as many Jews feel in other countries in the world. And we met people who've been to Israel 30 and 40 times, who every vacation they have come to volunteer on the kibbutzim or to volunteer in backroom jobs in the Israeli army. So it's not like Israel doesn't have friends and advocates, even in the most difficult of places like Europe. But the mainstream in the intelligentsia, in the media, is coming from a much darker place.
You alluded to the different terms for the Arab Spring and Islamic Winter. I just wanted to turn to that for a moment and ask you, Ms. Lazaroff, because I know that you taught a course on journalism and social media, and there seems to be a great dispute as to how influential social media was as a catalyst for change in Egypt and other places. For many people, the defining image of those uprisings, if you think of, you know, in this continent, CNN and other places, was a young woman or a young man with like a smartphone, and that's what sticks in people's minds. But there's been a backlash against that perception. There were articles that I read by people like Malcolm Gladwell and others who argue that, in essence, it's people who make revolutions and not social media that makes revolutions. And there's also a dispute about how much free press and internet freedom there currently is in the Arab world, which I'm also very curious about, like how free is it. So I'm wondering if you could address how important you think social media is now in influencing opinion about the Middle East, especially among young people, and secondly, how much of a factor it is or will be in opening up freedom of thought in the Arab world.
I think social media is tremendously important. It's true that people make change, but to do that, they need tools, and the ability of everybody to send out messages, right, just using their smartphone or a computer. I mean, it used to be that if I observed something or if I wanted to say something, I needed the permission of a newspaper. Now, as a single person, I can have a following that is big, as big or even bigger than a newspaper. So my ability as an individual, and particularly in the Arab world, to affect change through social media is a tremendous platform that allows people in the Arab world to communicate in ways that they never could. It allows Arab leaders to communicate in a way that they never could. The fact that the president of Iran feels like he needs to go on Twitter to talk, right, and that he himself enters the stream of communication in a way is a major acquiescence to democratic procedure.
I think many people here are curious about how exposed people in those countries would be to what we would consider freedom of the press or freedom of thought. Like, do they really know, do they gain access to things outside of their sphere?
Well, the internet allows them to, the internet allows them to do that in ways that they couldn't before.
And the internet is free or censored in these places?
It depends on the country. Yeah. But, yeah.
Both of you, Mr. Kay and Mr. Rosner, are working in internet domains as well, blogs. What's your impression about how the work you do in print vis-a-vis the work you don't do in print? Is there a difference in terms of response, reaction, readership, especially on Middle East issues?
Yeah, well, the internet is it's a double-edged sword because it's great being able to reach an international audience. I wrote an article about, of all things, Bangladesh. There's actually a conflict between a largely secular government and an Islamist opposition in Bangladesh, which somewhat mirrors the situation in Egypt, but not a lot of people are following it. It's quite obscure, even though Bangladesh is a much bigger country than most other Muslim countries. And I wrote about it, and I started getting email from Bangladesh. I said, oh, this is fantastic. You know, this is just the way the internet was supposed to be when we talked about it in utopian terms 25 years ago. You know, we were all, I don't know if people remember those days, we were all going to have pen pals all around the world and educate ourselves by reading all kinds of things and learn new languages. But what turned out, in fact, to be the case is that most people use the internet to get their own views read back to them by people. So, again, it's the problem of silos. And that, unfortunately, is the problem is that, you know, you get pro-Israeli writers writing for a largely pro-Israeli audience and, say, pro-Palestinian writers writing for a largely pro-Palestinian audience. The other question of comments that are left on newspaper websites is a huge problem because there are several issues that always attract really, really vicious comments. I mean, the Middle East is one of them, abortion. Here in Canada, any discussion of Quebec or native issues just brings out, like, instantly, like, the most vicious bigots imaginable. And unfortunately, the Middle East is one of those things where sometimes I'll write an article, within 20 minutes there's 100 comments, and we just end up deleting all of them because half of them contain hate speech on both sides. So it's that's a real problem.
So wait, Jonathan, can I just ask you, you don't see in Twitter the ability for people on different sides to communicate, say like Peter Lerner exchanging Twitter messages with the Al-Aqsa Brigade, for example, something, you know, that cuts across. If your point was that people are talking to their own, I think on Twitter what's happening is people who could never before be having conversations are having conversations. I mean, the notion of a former IDF spokesman, you know, talking with the Al-Aqsa Brigade.
That's true. And in fact, on NPR last week, there was this fascinating example of an American journalist who was actually communicating in real time with someone in Al-Shabaab in Somalia. And just like that. And that guy ended up getting killed during the course of their Twitter correspondence. So it's like completely surreal situation, which, as you say, wouldn't have happened before. I think this creates opportunities for journalists, and it creates opportunities for propagandists. You know, NATO and the Taliban, for instance, have had sort of ongoing Twitter war going in Afghanistan for years. I'm still waiting for the day when the Twitter war replaces the shooting war, as opposed to being just kind of a sideshow to it. But it would be wonderful if our battles 10 years from now will be fought via Twitter instead of, you know, in Waziristan.
So I want to add, Elliot, I can completely concur with you, Jonathan, about the not just the difficulties of comments or talkbacks on websites, but the evils of them. And I'll tell you a personal story. About 2 years ago, Prime Minister Harper gave a speech in Ottawa on anti-Semitism at the International Interparliamentary Union Against Anti-Semitism, and it was a magnificent speech, classic text. I think it'll go down in the annals of modern history as a clarion call of courage. And I wrote an article together with my colleague, Professor Ephraim Inbar, at the Begin Sadat Center for Strategic Studies, analyzing Harper's speech and praising him for his clear moral thinking. And the Globe and Mail picked up that article, which we published on our own, and they ran it in the Globe and Mail. One of my colleagues called me from Canada and said, have you seen the talkbacks? I never look at talkbacks. But since this was me, I went and looked. There were 1,000 comments, talkbacks, on this article praising Harper on the Globe and Mail website.
99% of them viciously, fiercely anti-Israel, and plenty of them bordering on worse than being anti-Israel. And I said to my colleagues, you know, I've been out of Canada for a couple of years. This is what's become of Canada? And he said, no, you don't understand. He said, crackpots exist in every society. They've always been there. It's just that the talkback feature allows them to come out of the woodwork and get printed on the internet. I wonder whether that's a good thing.
Oh, I have a better story about talkbacks. I think it was 2006. I was running my daily blog. It was then still on the Haaretz website. And my editor was somewhat concerned by the fact that I didn't have enough talkbacks. There were a couple other bloggers with more talkbacks than I had. And he knew that the number of readers that I was getting was pretty high, but not enough talkbacks. And he thought that I was not creating enough material for heated discussion. So he told me, why don't you have more talkbacks? I said, I write about topics that might not ignite the same heated response that you're used to, but if you want me to have talkbacks, I can easily have talkbacks. How many talkbacks do you want? So he said, well, you know, your recent articles only had 50 or 60 talkbacks. Can you get to 300 or 400? I said, okay. Tomorrow, you'll have 300 talkbacks. And I wrote an article about Jimmy Carter. It was 350 or 400. A week later, he comes back to me and says, okay, I realized you can do that with Jimmy Carter. But since that article, the number went down again to 50 or 60 per day. Can you write another article? I said, sure. How many talkbacks do you want? And I wrote an article about Ron Paul. This one got 800 or 900 comments, and that's how I found the magic bullet. I've been using Ron Paul since then. Every once in a while, whenever I feel I don't have enough talkbacks, I write either about Ron Paul or evangelical Christians in a Jewish newspaper. You get as many talkbacks as you want.
I don't even know what to say to that.
It's a true story.
Here in Canada, it's Elizabeth May is the person. Yeah. And it's actually interesting. The Ron Paul phenomenon is interesting because sometimes there's these figures. Sarah Palin was another one. Rob Ford is another one. These folks who, you know, it's not like they're the most powerful or respected politicians around, but they just have this magnetic effect on talkbacks.
Their followers tend to write talkbacks.
Editor is telling you, Shmulik, is that you're not entertaining enough. And you need to entertain the audience more. You need to be more provocative. You need to be more sensationalist. You need to be less sophisticated and write about things that'll bring in talkbacks. And again, I wonder whether that's a good thing.
I'll consider this.
I mean, I think you're missing, I mean, the real talkbacks, the real action's on the celebrity websites. That's where you really have to
TMZ and Perez Hilton.
On a more serious note, in a couple of programs, those of you who've been here the last few years, we've had Brett Stevens basically sitting in the chair next to me a couple of times, and he raises what I think is a fundamental issue when it comes to thinking about the Middle East. He writes, quote, moral clarity is a term that doesn't get much traction these days, least of all among journalists who prefer objectivity and balance. Yet good journalism is more than about separating fact from opinion and being fair. Good journalism is about fine analysis and making distinctions. And this applies as much to moral distinctions as to any others. Because too many reporters today refuse to make moral distinctions. We are left with a journalism whose narrative and analytical failings have become ever more glaring. And I was thinking about that based on your earlier conversation. So I'd like to take you back to that and ask you what you think the priorities of a journalist should be in this spectrum between ostensible objectivity on one side of the spectrum and what he calls moral clarity
on the other side of the spectrum. And just to twist the screw a little bit, you yourself, Mr. Kay, have written about moral clarity with regard to the Lebanon War and the two conflicts in Gaza. And I just want to go back to what you wrote so we can throw that into the mix. You wrote that the media coverage always follows a predictable pattern. In all three cases described above, that's Lebanon 2006, Gaza 2008, and Gaza last year, international reports generally are fairly balanced until such time as Israel actually exercised its right to self-defense. And at that point, reporters began turning the struggle into a David versus Goliath narrative that ignores the morally essential question of who started the conflict. So there you're actually invoking it. So I'd like us to return to this issue, and we can go around the table, of whether the media should have a moral point of view. And if there's moral hesitation, is that because reporters don't have a moral point of view, or they're suppressing it, or they don't think their readers are interested? I'm trying to understand here. Let's start with you.
Okay. So, yes. In some cases, there are morally important distinctions that readers need to know about. And a great example is killing civilians. American drones in Pakistan and Afghanistan, it's true, the American government admits it, have killed civilians as collateral damage as part of attacks against Taliban targets, including, for instance, the type of attack that killed the Pakistani Taliban leader this week. Yeah, that's quite a major hit. However, it is a morally important detail that these drone strikes are targeting Taliban figures, and sometimes it is completely true they do kill women and children. To my mind, that there's a moral distinction between that and someone who walks into a restaurant, blows himself up, and deliberately kills civilians. It doesn't require someone to pick sides to take note of that distinction, because it is a distinction that readers will find important. If tomorrow Barack Obama ordered a drone strike against a school full of Pakistani children because he wanted to kill Pakistani children, which of course he would never do, but if he did it, it would be a morally salient fact to point out that that school was targeted for the purpose of killing civilians. So what I wrote in that article, I believe is true, is that there are certain morally important things. And 2006 in Lebanon is a very good example, because essentially that war began because Hezbollah kidnapped Israeli soldiers. And that is a morally important thing. It doesn't require a news reporter to adopt a partisan or morally one-sided tone in order to know this is a detail that I have to report. I have to tell my readers who started the conflict. And in terms of this narrative changing, what typically changes the narrative, I don't think it's necessarily anti-Semitism, and in some cases it's not even anti-Zionism. Sometimes it's just the availability of video images. Because what's happened in Lebanon and Gaza, because Israel is a militarily powerful country, most of the casualties, both military and otherwise, that are inflicted in 2006 were on Lebanon. Not all of them, but most of them. And Hezbollah, very intelligently, from a very selfish point of view, they had guided tours for all the journalists to see the rubble whenever an Israeli missile hit an apartment building. Within minutes, they were ready to give people a guided tour. And news editors, whatever their political bias, they will respond to the availability of video footage that is shocking. And that's what leads the next day's news. And unfortunately, I don't think that that has a lot to do with, you know, deep-seated religious or political biases. A lot of it is just, what kind of footage do we have? You know, what's going to lead the next day's news?
Newspapers moralize and take sides every single day when they choose the stories they're going to cover and the stories they're not going to cover. Now, I've never been a working journalist. I'm an opinion columnist. Most of my life, I've been a spokesman working the media to place stories. One of the places I work in Israel is the largest hospital in the country, the Sheba Medical Center at Tel Shomer, largest hospital in the Middle East. Many Arab and Palestinian patients. So here's two vignettes. After the Hamas military coup against the Fatah in Gaza, during which Hamas literally chopped off the arms and legs of Fatah policemen, we had at the hospital undergoing rehab those Fatah policemen. Palestinians dismembered by fellow Palestinians. And they were being outfitted with prosthetic arm and legs and going through rehabilitation at an Israeli hospital with Jewish Israeli doctors at Israeli expense. Couldn't get any foreign journals to cover the story. They weren't interested. However, several months later, if you remember, there was a missile attack on Sderot. Hit two brothers, the Tweeto brothers, who were out playing, didn't pay attention to the siren, didn't go to the safe room. And each one lost a leg and one lost an arm. And the Tweeto brothers were at Sheba in the hospital being treated. And they were in the same room as a Palestinian kid, about the same age, who had been hit in an Israeli bombardment of Gaza. Now that was a story. New York Times ran it on the front page because there's balance there. That's a story they were willing to cover. The Israelis are victims of Palestinian violence, and the Palestinians are victims of Israeli violence. Now we're balanced, now it's even, now that's okay, that's a story. But Palestinians being slaughtered by other Palestinians, chopped up to pieces and rehabbed in an Israeli hospital, that's not a story. So newspapers make editorial judgments and moralize about the conflict every single day.
I think one of the problems we're having here is the mixing of problems with journalism with other problems, such as the political philosophy according to which proportional response is the only permissible response for a country in a situation of conflict. And Israel suffers when we talk about the journalistic coverage of Israeli actions. This is not because of media bias against Israel. There is media bias against Israel of some journalists. But I think the real reason for which Israel suffers is because today, in many circles in the Western world, the only response that Israel would be allowed to do or to act upon is a proportional response. Namely, as soon as Israel begins to win a war, it can no longer be the justifiable side to the conflict. The media, David was talking about the balance. This attempt by a newspaper to always strike a balance is really a manifestation of helplessness or of inability to decide who's wrong and who's right. And since media editors and writers around the world don't truly understand the situation and are getting tired of getting the complaints of both sides, the only logical conclusion they can reach is, okay, we are not going to do any story that might present one of the parties as the righteous party. In every case, we will be looking for balance, and that will clear everything up for us. We have a Palestinian, we have an Israeli, and it's for you to decide who's right and who's wrong.
Yeah, I think if I were to go back to your original point about from Brett Stevens, I think his description about the moral imperative is a very good description of the difference between an opinion writer and a journalist, right? An opinion writer wants to talk about the morality of the situation, why you need to think that Israel is justified or not justified, why the actions of Hamas are horrific or not horrific. My job as a reporter is to provide you with information, right? I don't want to tell you what to think. I want to give you the information to think. The moment I tell you how to think, as Jonathan pointed out, I'm limiting the conversation. And I want the information, I want the story to go out to the broadest audience possible. Therefore, I want to present it in the broadest terms. So I don't think that journalism suffers from a lack of morality, but I do think there is a difference between domestic journalism and international journalism, if you will. I think that the ethic of journalism about having to present both sides, for example, if I'm talking about an election, right, If I'm presenting you with information on the candidates for an election, I don't choose for you that this is the candidate that we're going to talk about and this is the candidate we're not going to talk about because I think one candidate is morally superior to the other. My obligation is to present you with information about all the candidates. If it's an abortion issue, if it's an issue about vouchers for schools, there are a host of issues where when you open the pages of your newspaper, you want to have both sides. You imagine that you need to have both sides, and that's part of the democratic debate. The moment you move beyond domestic issues into international issues, newspapers do a much poorer job of presenting both sides, right? So when you talk about American coverage of the war in Iraq, for example, I don't think American newspapers did a very good job of presenting the human casualties of the war, if you will. When you talk about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the problem is that for us, we see it in that way of a international conflict where we have more of one side, whereas most of the foreign media treats it as a two-sided debate. So I think it's hard. It's like almost two conversations that are going across purposes. But if I were to just make one other point, which is about the Gaza thing, I think it's very hard when you're talking about a disproportional conflict to compare, say, 1,000 casualties with 20 or 30 casualties. I think making that case is very difficult for...
Takes it into another area, which is an area in moral philosophy, which is whether numbers matter. But one of the things that struck me, and I actually want to come back to you, Mr. Kay, because I'll tell you a story, and it ties into what you were talking about. So when I teach in university and the subject comes up about Israel, and I'll talk factually about a date. So we'll talk about, because you noted the 2006 conflict was started because soldiers were kidnapped. Now, I've said similar things about similar dates, and this brings up what I internally call the problem of historical regression, meaning that somebody will immediately say to me, Pavlovian, yeah, will say to me, yes, but the reason they kidnapped the soldier, yeah, was, and it goes all the way back. And I've had this experience countless times that you can actually... Never
the way back to when? 48?
Oh, no, no. Oh, no.
The
no,
no, second temple, yeah, destroyed?
No, 1940.
No, no. Year 70, the destruction of the second temple?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It goes back as a form of kabuki theater.
So what do you do with that?
Oh, well, this is why if I'm at a dinner party or something and someone talks about Israel, I immediately switch the subject because I can script both sides. Like, you know, and it goes like this. It says, you know, someone will say, oh, wasn't it terrible, you know, the Israelis killed a bunch of people with a counter-terrorist attack. And then another guy says, well, yeah, but they did that because of this terrorist attack that happened yesterday. And the guy says, well, yeah, but the terrorist attack, that's because of the blockade. The guy says, well, yeah, but the blockade is because of this thing. And then it says, well, yeah, but that thing happened because of 1948 and all the Arab armies ganging up on Israel and trying to exterminate the Jews. It says, well, yeah, but they did that because the Zionist project itself was so racist. And it says, well, how can you say the Zionist project is so racist when Jews have been there for 3,500 years? And then... there's nothing to say after that because that's the dawn of recorded literary history in the Middle East. So within 90 seconds, you will have gone from what happened 20 minutes ago that someone read on Twitter,
right,
to something that happened 3,500 years ago. I've seen that argument happen all the time. I see it happen on talk radio. I see it happen at dinner parties. And it is very scripted. Like it's just it is like a Japanese kabuki thing where everyone, here's the part where he talks about Herzl. Yeah, this is good. Like I like this part. So now And this is why, going back to Bret Stephens, you know, Bret Stephens is a wonderful speaker. He's a wonderful writer. But what is he, who does he write for? He writes for the Wall Street Journal editorial page. He writes for Commentary Magazine. You know, Commentary Magazine is a great magazine, but every word in it is a piece of opinion. It doesn't purport to be a news journal. And so, of course, he talks about moral clarity, because what columnist doesn't talk about moral clarity? There's no columnist in the world that says, I'm going to be morally opaque. And, you know, it's just... And the reason I don't like the term moral clarity is because the other side can use it. You know, I can be reading a columnist in an Arab publication. He can say, I'm all for moral clarity. And the moral principle on which I stand is the principle of national self-determination, including Palestinian national self-determination. And then every word he writes will be full of moral clarity in the service of the moral cause that he selected. And nothing he writes will resonate with me or anybody in this room. And it'll be a complete dialogue of the deaf with both sides talking about moral clarity. So it's a noble sounding phrase, but I don't think it has any place in news journalism.
There's no question that what you describe as historical regression is the way to lose any audience. I get this in the Jewish community all the time. How come you don't bring so-and-so to come speak? We'll talk about the San Remo conference and prove that we have legal rights in Jerusalem. That goes, it's a dead end. You lose everybody immediately. What sophisticated media strategists and pollsters try to teach Israeli politicians, for example, and it's very hard to get them to do this, is to talk only about the future. What the audience wants to hear is, what are you doing to end the conflict? What are you doing to bring about peace? What is your vision of the future? Don't give me the whole background to prove how right you are and how wrong the other side is. People turn off and tune out immediately, no matter how right you are, no matter how right you think you are. What you need to tell people is, this is what we're doing now. This is what we're prepared to, where we're prepared to go. This is where we're prepared to compromise. This is what we're prepared to do, and to show them how, in Israel's case, how Israel is looking towards a progressive vision of the future. That's the only way to win over the hearts and minds of all those people out there who otherwise simply tune off and tune out of the conflict.
I find in Jewish communities that that's a hard narrative, and I'll tell you why. There's a wonderful Canadian philosopher, Charles Taylor, who talks about something called the politics of recognition, which is that if you start talking about the future, they say, yeah, but I want you to recognize this is what happened. This is what happened in 67. This is what happened in 48. And the Balfour Declaration happened in 17. And so you sort of can't move until there's like this tacit recognition of all the things that have happened, and it sort of freezes the narrative at that point.
Although this is sort of a tangent, I realize, but what you just described is what makes it very difficult to have conversations about Aboriginal policy. Because, you know, to say, well, you know, this is the problems facing this community, let's do what we... And then next thing you know, it's about residential schools and all that stuff. So there's a whole range of identity politics issues that become very difficult to talk about for the reason you just described.
And it's worth pointing out this is on both sides. In other words, if you look in Arab media or Arab literature or Arab fiction... So it's also talking about history, and it's going back and back and back and back and back until, you know, you're not sure where the starting line really is for all of this stuff. But let's look forward then and talk about what the next generation, what future generations are going to understand about this conflict, what they're reading or not reading about it, what they're watching about it and tweeting about it. So I'll just leave everybody with the following quote from Adam Garfinkel at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. He said a couple of years ago that he believes there are four objectives when it comes to communicating about major events in the world to our children. And the very first one is to know the facts. Here's what he writes. How have we done in this country, he's talking about America, how have we done in this country over the past decade in teaching our children the facts, not just about 9/11, but about the Middle East as a whole? I don't know the answer to that question, which might actually be a subject open to empirical research, but my anecdotal experience is that we have done terribly. Not only have we not taught our children very much factually about this region, and by that I mean basic geographical, ethno-linguistic, historical, anthropological, and political facts,
But our political class in this country seems to demonstrate a learning curve that is virtually flat as well. And he goes on to talk about the fact that people, if you did like a poll about basic things, would not know, for instance, that Iran is not an Arab country, or what an Arab is, or even what kind of term the word Arab is, or is an Arab automatically a Muslim, and etc. Just basic, basic things. And if you can't distinguish these elemental differences in the Middle East, you can't understand anything about the place. So he has a very pessimistic take, in other words, about what young people know about the situation and what they're going to know. And I wonder if you agree, if you disagree, what your experience has been with younger readers, younger people. Do you think the media can do a better job in getting the facts out, if that is its job at all, or are people, younger people, interested, disinterested? How do you feel?
Younger people is your department.
Glad to know I've become the expert on young people. I think most young people are getting their news from social media. So I think, and that they're being influenced by factors that almost don't come into have not even come into debate in this discussion.
Such as?
I mean, well, we're worrying about whether or not reporters should be moralizing. We're worrying about the difference between a reporter and an opinion writer. But they're not getting, a lot of them are not getting their information from what we would consider official reporters at all. They're getting their information from Facebook. They're getting their information from Twitter. They're getting their information from individuals who are passing on either, you know, videos or tweets or photographs, who are people with a message to get out. You know, I think that the line increasingly, as we go, the line between public relations and news, it gets obscured and lost, and I'm not sure that young people understand the differential between what I heard and what I know. And in you know, the age of information overflow, I think they're getting more opinion than fact, and therefore it's harder for them to formulate maybe a factually based.
Right, so ironically you're saying,
yes,
young people are getting more propaganda, in,
yes,
fact. As we move,
you
further,
know that complaining about young people is
It's not because they're young. It's not because they're young. It's because we don't exist enough in the place where they're having their conversation.
I'll say that two things. First of all, the good news about young people is that one day they'll become older people. And maybe then they'll be more interested in the news. The second thing is that it's a habit of every generation to complain or worry about how the next generation will absorb, analyze, interpret the information and govern the world. And every generation eventually is disappointed to discover that the next generation is also capable of doing all those complicated things. So, you know, whether they get their information from Twitter or Facebook or the newspapers or something, some new platform that was not even invented, doesn't much matter. I'm sure that if they need the information, if they need it to make their own decisions and to govern their own societies when their time comes, they'll find a way of getting the information, analyzing it, and do the necessary things.
So there's an explosion of schools and programs for communication and journalism in Israel. And there are literally thousands of Israeli youngsters today studying communications and journalism. And in all the years that I've hired young PR people for different clients, only once did I hire someone from one of those PR communication or journalism tracks, and it was a mistake. I'd much rather hire a young student who studied English or Hebrew or history or political science for two reasons. Number one, because then they can write. and they come out of the journalism communication schools and they can't write. Second of all, they have a sense of perspective. They've learned a little bit more how to think critically. I'm a big believer in Israel's youth. I think we have the most fantastic youth in the world. My kids are all at that age, as late teenagers, mid-20s, and I look at them and their contemporaries, and they're as capable, if not more capable, than my generation or my parents' generation, so I don't think this should be a conversation coming down on them at all. They take enormous burdens upon themselves. They are motivated. They're idealistic. They're ideologically committed. It's a fantastic generation. The question is, what are we teaching them? Are we teaching them how to hold a camera and how to look on TV? Or are we teaching them history, English, and other critical thinking skills that will make them good journalists as well?
Yeah, to my mind, the limiting factor isn't the technology we use to teach people, the pedagogy, Twitter, Facebook, all this stuff. The limiting factor is the intellectual curiosity of the average human being. And the intellectual curiosity of the average human being in regard to things happening thousands of miles away is extremely limited. Most of us care a lot about ourselves, we care a lot about our family, we care a little bit about our neighborhood and our colleagues, we care, you know, a smattering for our fellow citizens, and we just don't give a crap for people outside our country, with the narrow exception of people who have a close religious or ethnic connection to people in some distant homeland, as many Jews do to Israel. So that's the big problem. As a journalist, I try and seize windows of opportunity. For instance, after the Boston bombing, for about 8 seconds, people were interested in Chechnya. And, you know, Chechnya is actually an incredibly fascinating place. It's probably, you know, one of the most violent places on earth. I mean, just a hell on earth in many respects. But the history of Muslims in that region is extremely interesting, and Russian subjugation and this and that. And I took that opportunity to lecture people.
Your 8 seconds are over.
Yeah. cut off. Someone yanked this cord. So I took that opportunity, and it was great. I felt really important. But like 3 days later, no one cared about Chechnya. And I'll give you an example. My wife is she's a lawyer. She's really smart. She has all sorts of degrees from McGill. And once we were having a conversation about Korea, because I just interviewed this guy who was actually a guard at a North Korean gulag, and he had escaped into South Korea.
I remember that.
It was just an amazing story. And she interrupted me and said, "Oh yeah, Korea. Remind me, North South. Which one is the evil one?" And this is like a really smart person. You know, this is a really smart person talking about an important rogue country. And I could have told her anything. "Oh yeah, South Korea. That's the evil one. Yeah, you should tell your friends at work about this." But I mean, the example illustrates how, you know, she's a genius at taking care of her house. She's a genius at her job. She's a genius at this, that, and the other. But she doesn't care about Korea because it has no influence on her life. And for 80% of people, as I say, the Middle East also falls into that category.
I just want to assure you now, John, that your wife is not going to see the tape, okay?
Oh, yeah. That's why I came here under a pseudonym.
I know the hour is getting late, and I assume that people may have questions. So we're going to open it up to the floor. We're going to bring a mic out in front, and we have a few minutes to do so. But before we do, could you please give them a warm hand? Okay, so as always, I'm going to ask everybody to make their questions and not speeches, and make them as brief as possible. And we're just going to... Do you have a standing mic? Yeah, we're going to bring a standing mic.
That'd be fun. Do you have a card?
Please indicate who your question is for.
Just a question for the panel. Most interesting, your comments. Oh, you can't hear me. Wow. Okay, this is a question for the panel, because your opinions are of great interest to me, and I'm a follower of the media, and as we listen to what the problem is with the coverage of events in Israel by Western media primarily, as I listen to the answers, I keep thinking about the 500-pound canary that's sitting behind you. Only one speaker mentioned the fact that anti-Semitism may, in fact, be a factor in a very hostile coverage of Israel. It isn't just that the people have gone to sleep and they're tired of the conflict. Obviously, the editors of the London Times, I believe, obviously don't feel that their readership has gone to sleep. They have published a cartoon that belongs really in the Volkischer, what was it called? Beobachter. That is not an opinion of an editor that thinks that his readership is really not interested in it. The other is 150 or 200 million Europeans today think that Israel is the most dangerous country in the world, barring Iran, barring North Korea, barring any other country that may be much more dangerous in the world than Israel. I wonder if some of you would want to address that. It's amazing how you talked about things, the boredom of the people, et cetera, et cetera.
Take a couple. Okay, so we'll take any others? We'll take a few at a time. Yeah, so you got to come up.
It always diffuses the tension in the room if you pick a couple questions.
That's true, actually. That's good. I don't remember that.
What does our panel feel about the impact of a potential oil and gas deal with Turkey or Greece? Is it going to be Turkey or is it going to be Greece? And what's the impact on Israel? Is there going to be a dividend, an economic dividend to the average Israeli citizen?
Well, it's a similar one. What the changes in Turkey in the last few years, what can they be countered? And the media in Turkey, are they at all independent?
Sorry, I'll repeat them all at the end.
My question is, is the media afraid of the Muslims? They're afraid to attack them. We had Salman Rushdie who was afraid. We had Van Gogh who was killed because of his opinion. And everybody is afraid to say anything. I have gone to movies and I have not seen any Muslims as the bad people. They've been North Koreans, they've been Russians, but leave the Muslims out.
All right, so I'm going to repeat the four questions. Thank you. The first question is whether, in fact, anti-Semitism is a distinct factor in editorial and journalistic policy. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll take it. I don't think that anti-Semitism is behind a lot of the coverage. And I think it's almost a mistake to simplify it by thinking that the issue is anti-Semitism. I think the issue is that the conflict has become, in some ways, so dumbed down over the years into sort of good guys, bad guys, Palestinian victim, Israeli aggressors, that people are simply on autopilot. They're not thinking as much, and they're presenting information about a long, very well-worn tracks. Also, their frame and our frame are not going to be the same, but I don't see that a lot of the coverage in major newspapers can be boiled down to a simple issue of they're anti-Semitic and they hate us. I think that's where, you know, I see you're going to see that much more on social media than you're going to see that in the mainstream media.
Just linking that up to the last question that was asked, which is, fear of a Muslim demographic, Salman Rushdie, et cetera, whether that, I assume that's never consciously on the minds of people editorial staff, so does it ever play unconsciously?
If I could jump into that last one, I just, by coincidence, a week ago, I was sitting at a similar panel at the Sheraton Hotel on Queen Street, and the conference was on Islamophobia. And I was in a room about this size with about this many people, all of them or most of them Muslims, and they were convinced that the media is completely Islamophobic. And they, you know, there's all sorts of clippings about, like, the way Muslims are depicted and this and that. And, you know, I got to say that some of the stuff they said, they had a point. I told them I didn't think it was what it is. It's terrorphobia. It's not Islamophobia. And when we report when there's terrorism and it has people who say I'm doing this, I'm blowing something up because to please Allah, we're going to report that. So I don't think the media is Islamophobic. I also don't think we're particularly anti-Semitic. I think a lot of the stuff that seems anti-Semitic, you know, it's interesting, you know, who are the most anti-Israel writers in Canada? You know, Naomi Klein, Judy Rebick, you know, a lot of them are Jews, right? So you can talk about self-hating Jews, but the biggest factor, in my opinion, is sublimated post-colonialism, is that Western society, there's this huge guilt complex about colonial societies. And a lot of people see a parallel between the West Bank and, the, you know, Algeria for France. Like, you look at a country like Belgium. Belgium killed 10 million black people in Belgian Congo because of a colonial project. They're extremely sensitive to any geopolitical situation that kind of reminds them of white people who are rich and powerful and militarily empowered going into a context and oppressing indigenous people. And you could say, well, that has nothing to do with Israel. I would argue, I agree with you, it doesn't have much to do with Israel. But is if they see any kind of similitude at all, it triggers this political guilt reflex. And to us, maybe it sometimes looks like anti-Semitism because there's a double standard. My belief is that double standard is sublimated colonial guilt and also sublimated Marxism. You know, don't forget, there's a lot of Marxists who had nothing to do after 1989, right? They were twiddling their thumbs. No, it's true. They, you know, the class struggle, exploited versus exploiter, and then the Berlin Wall fell, and it was like, aha. And then they sort of transferred this exploited versus exploiter model that they learned during the Cold War. They applied it to Israel. And the same is true in Toronto, by the way, of gay rights activists. I'm sure everybody in this room is familiar with Queers Against Israeli Apartheid. And I've spoken to a lot of these people, and a lot of these people are people who fought the long and noble fight for gay rights. And then gay marriage was declared the law of the land in 2005. And they're like, yes, all right, now I got to do something with my life. And then if you're a professional activist, you latch onto something. And a lot of these people latched onto Israel as a surrogate for some of the issues that they successfully fought for earlier in their activist careers. And to my mind, there's a lot of that going on. Former Marxists, former identity politics people, former gay rights people, who simply have latched on to the Palestinian cause because they're underemployed.
The question about Turkey, you can field that one.
So the Strategic Studies Center that I'm affiliated with has been on the Turkey file for just over 20 years, and I have hosted many Turkish academics and journalists in Israel and written about this, so I have a very clear perspective. There are more journalists in jail in Turkey today than in any other place in the world. Journalists and generals. Erdogan has moved very smartly, very clearly, to crush opposition. And while he hasn't jailed academics, the academics are cowed into silence. We had a situation just a couple months ago at a conference in Israel, to which three very prominent Turkish academics were invited. And they got so scared and almost dropped off the panel because there was someone that we put on the panel with them who had a very prominent critique of Turkey that had made it back into the Turkish press. And they were afraid to be seen by the, in the Turkish media back at home as having sat on a panel with this person. There's no question there is a atmosphere of fear in Erdogan's Turkey, and I don't need to begin to describe to you his record of hostility to Israel in recent years and his anti-Semitism. There's one place that you can put a finger on and say the man is not just building a career based on attacking Israel. He actually is an anti-Semite. I don't see Turkish-Israel relations improving much anytime soon, despite Prime Minister Netanyahu's humble pie, the apology that he issued to the Turks months ago. And by the way, it was not under American pressure. This was Israel making the decision to issue the apology to the Turks because we have a lot of important strategic interests that we need to settle with the Turks. It hasn't worked. It hasn't worked, and the Turks continue on their rampage against Israel. There was a side question relating to Turkey, regarding oil, gas, natural gas. Yeah.
Okay, well, that's the good news. I mean, I'm very positive about Israel's future, despite everything we discussed, despite all the detractors, despite all the anti-Semites, despite all the naysayers, despite all the boycotters, despite everything, I think that Israel's future is extraordinarily bright. We have everything going the right way for us. It's another conversation. It's another speech. Among those is the discovery of natural gas off our coasts. So after all those years of jokes about Moses making the wrong turn in the desert and the Arabs ending up with all the oil, guess what? Turns out we have energy as well, and if we handle it correctly, which is a big issue in Israeli politics, Israel should become even a net energy exporter. And the Russians, the Turks, the Greeks, and everybody else are trying to get in on it and buy a piece of the Israeli action, and it's just more blessing. All good.
Thank you very much.
That's it, we're done.